Hello everyone, and welcome to the most diced game dev podcast in the world, House of Games. Today, I'm joined by my host, Otto, and a returning guest who refused to leave us alone despite the Brexit. This man is very much into cats, slugs, and, well, that's it. From the Great Britain, welcome back to our shores, Mr. Jamie. So, my friends, let's roll the dice and see what this episode of House of Games have to offer.
Welcome everyone to the House of Games and our returning guest with us today, Jamie. If everyone here has heard the last episode where Jamie introduced himself, I don't think we need a lengthy one, but you could give us a elevator pitch of who you are, and then we're going to go straight into your other project, actually, which is another game. So you could just tell us who you are again and tell us about the game that we're about to give you our review of.
Hi everyone, my name is Jamie and I'm the director of Kittens in Time Space. I'm here to talk to you about Kickback Slug, a physics-based obstacle avoidance game where you play as a little alien slug who relies on the kickback of his arsenal to navigate a very treacherous world.
Very good. And we actually got a couple of Steam keys to try it out. So, Ruin, do you want to start off with your experience of playing it?
Sure. I remember last time we played Catpunk, I just started talking about it without actually explaining what the game was. But now you, Jamie, you said, you put it very neatly there, a physics-based kickback. So I was thinking, how could I explain the game before I actually start talking about it? Well, basically, you're this slug, an alien slug, who has a gun, and then you put your mouse behind the gun and shoot, and that will catapult him in the opposite direction through this almost like a maze-ish environment. It sort of reminds me of an old Nintendo game where you are a spaceship and you help people, and then it's kind of physics-based, and then you can sort of pick people up and they can bounce into walls and stuff like that. But yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind when I played it. So that's like the main mechanic of the game. I think I played about 10 levels, and then I got stuck on one level, and then we started recording. One thing that stuck out to me straight away was the charming animations that are all over the game. Like, even the aim has like a small animation on it, sort of like pulsing the ding ding ding. And when you're in the menus, the slug is sort of animating as you go up and down. And I also noticed another thing, when you like reach the next level, there's like a circle fading in on the slug, and then it sort of stops briefly out and then back in, if that makes sense. It's quite hard to explain it in words. But I was thinking, I don't know if you're going to start to ask questions or...
I could also give my sort of impressions of the game. I have a little list here that I can do if you want, if you're finished with your bits.
Yeah, I just sort of wrote down things that really impressed me. That was more like the way I was thinking while I was playing the game.
Yeah. All right. So I have a sort of a good things and things that need to be improved list. I'll just start with the good things and then we'll get into the rest. So first of all, I would say it's a really nice feeling that you get when just opening the game. It's sort of a really nostalgic feeling. We talked about it last episode that we did with you, which is Jazz Jackrabbit is sort of a game that it reminds me of a bit, this one also, because of the music and sort of menu and the sort of energy and vibe, which is a nice game, and it's, you get excited to play it just by opening the start menu. So kudos to that, and also great music in the gameplay as well, and great sound effects. It's sort of, feelings-wise, it's right on the money, I guess.
Great, thank you.
And voice acting as well was great. So when you start the game, there's sort of a intro cutscene, which has great voice acting, it has good humor. So that was also sort of a really good way to start off. It sort of also reminded me a little bit of Ratchet and Clank, sort of this, I don't know if it's the 90s or early 2000s, but that sort of platformery vibe to the characters and stuff. So that was very good. All right, so then to the list of things to be improved, I guess.
Okay, hit me.
Yes, so first of all, I think this should be, I don't know how it's built, but I think it shouldn't be that much to fix. But so I have an old ThinkPad, which is made for doing Excel and not gaming. So take this with a grain of salt. But it's sort of laggy on old computers or bad computers, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think probably there's just something that needs to be optimized. But other than that, it was kind of smooth, but in some parts it's sort of laggy. So some performance stuff, I guess. And then I have some UI stuff, some UX stuff, that I think also should be quite easy to fix. But there's just, you know, I'm a nitpicky person, so take that with a grain of salt also. So this is the just the options menu, so this is not a game-breaking thing. But the slug that selects or highlights what is selected is sort of too big, so it sort of overlaps more than one option. So that way, if you sort of have to squint your eyes or something to just make sure which option is selected. So that's just one thing to do. Then after that we have, for me at least, when switching, this is also sort of, you only have to do it once, so probably nobody's gonna notice this bug, but I'm gonna just mention it anyway. So
go for it.
Yeah, so the language selection option. So when you switch the languages from like English to Russian or Spanish or whatever it might be, the switch is not simultaneous. So you switch and then one text changes language and then the next and then the next, so it's not synced. So if you click on it three times, it just scrolls through all of the stuff, which was, yeah, I don't know how you would solve that, but just something to bring up. Also, I would recommend a drop-down menu for the languages instead of a scroll.
Mm-hmm.
So say that you want Russian, for example, then you would have to click it six times and you don't even know if it's going to be in the list or not. So that's just something. And then I think the last, oh wait, there's two things. So the subtitles option, if you do it with the keyboard when switching stuff, like you do the left or right arrow to toggle if you want subtitles or not. But with using a mouse, the arrows are all the way to the side. So what you would want is sort of a toggle button next to it instead of switching left to right with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yep, okay.
So the only last thing is, let me also show another picture. It's a very small thing.
Oh God, I'm not ready for this. What I will say in my defense is a lot of the things you've raised are currently being addressed. I haven't tested the game on what is presumably ultra widescreen resolution yet.
Yeah, exactly. So that's also, and also, let me know if you want to cut any of this out.
Oh my God, that looks terrifying.
Yeah, so the boxes on the, I think this like is the collectibles menu. So that's, at least on my monitor, which is sort of like 3,440 times 1,000 something. The box is sort of,
is that an ultra wide one?
Yeah, I think so. So then the boxes go outside of their sort of container, which looks sort of jarring. But that was it. Other than that, amazing gameplay. I really liked the experience.
You know what? I will take that. I was like readying myself for some horrendous like gameplay feedback, but the fact it's all just UI polished, I'm very, very pleased with that. It's one of the most difficult things to get right. And in fact, I would love for you to leave this in the podcast because I think it draws attention to a very important issue in game development that we don't like doing, and that's making menus, ensuring a smooth user experience and things like that. It's always important to highlight those challenges, so I'll take that in the face.
But can I say though that my games also got complaints from these ultra wide douchebags out there, so I think Oda can go and fuck himself. I'm playing on a normal screen, so I don't have any of those issues that you're facing, Oda. My only
you can hire me as a tester then.
I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, how do you fix an ultra-wide problem? I have no clue, and I have no idea how much time it would take either. So I had to tell, like, some people who play Red Colony, like, I'm so sorry, I can't even fix it because I don't have an ultra-wide screen at home. So I would have to cough up like $2,000 just to buy an ultra-wide screen to then try to fix the problem, where I assume that you can with as an ultra-wide person. But you're not an ultra-wide person. I'm just saying, like, an ultra-wide screen person, I assume that you can make the screen like a normal size, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wow. You see, here's the thing, right? In Kickback Slug, you can set this in the player settings in Unity, because obviously this is another Unity game. I've actually locked it to 16:9 and 16:10 aspect ratio, so you can't technically play the build in ultra widescreen, which is why I assume a lot of games these days list ultra widescreen support as a selling point. To be honest, I'm not gonna lie, I never even thought about it, because as soon as I ticked those boxes to lock it at those aspect ratios, I didn't think I was gonna worry about it ever again. But now I am, and I think what I will do, just to do Otto some justice, is actually try to address it. And you're right as well, it's not something that's just easily fixed. It's you'd have to have a bit of code running that detects what the aspect ratio is and apply a bit of scaling to the UI. Which is something that's easily done. You just take the resolution and you kind of divide the... I think I can't remember which way around it is. That is it the height by the width? And it gives you a value that you can use to detect whether it's the correct aspect ratio. And then just scale it accordingly. So I'll give it a go, Otto, just for you. I'm going to do that just personally for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, as you said, it's not easily fixed. And even when in scenarios where you do that all the time, it's still often an issue. So say, for example, web development, where responsive design, which means that the what you're seeing adapts to the size of the screen you have. So for a website, you could have everything from a small phone to a tablet to a ultra-wide person like myself. So I get it. And I think in Unity, probably it's not any easier to make it responsive. So I absolutely get that it's not made. And as you said, Rune, not everyone has an ultra-wide monitor as well. So that makes it sort of hard to test as well.
Mm.
But yeah. When we're on the topic, would you like to tell us a little bit about the process of developing this game from origins to release?
Yes, okay, right. How long have we got? I'm going to assume not that long, so I'll try and provide a high-level summary. But there are some bits in the middle, I think, that might be worth addressing because it's kind of relevant to the discussion. But we'll see. You just feel free to jump in if I'm going on for too long. So, Kickback Slug started off as literally nothing more than a game jam. And we just finished the first, like, publishable prototype of Catpunk. And it was Christmas of 2020, and we wrapped up the demo by the end of the year. We shifted it out to publishers and started that sort of waiting process of getting feedback and sort of responding to it as and when we would get it. And we kind of thought, okay, we've burned ourselves out a little bit. Let's have a holiday by making another game. because why not, right? Because typical indie developers, we don't have just one project on the go. It's more like 100, right? Anyway, my co-founder and I, we were just messing around in Unity and just sort of coming up with ideas for prototypes of what could be a fun, and I'll say small game, quote unquote small, just to have a bit of fun. And if it works out and becomes something of interest, we could put it on itch and just let it go, right? So Dan was like, I think what could be fun is rather than focus on making a traditional platformer, so you may have noticed I didn't actually use the word platformer in my elevator pitch because, controversially, this is not a platformer. I consider a platformer to be that sort of typical gameplay scenario where you've got a character that responds to gravity and then you jump from platform to platform. Or the idea is to land on platforms to navigate, whereas in this game, it's pretty much the opposite. You want to avoid touching the walls, if at all possible. There's some of them are safe, some of them are deadly, and the idea is to master the ability to propel yourself in a direction and just chain those actions repeatedly to get to the exit. So we thought that would be quite a cool idea for a game, so I prototyped it. It was nothing more than a white dot in a square, inside a square that you would just kind of shoot yourself around. It was also a test to see how Unity handles physics, because with Catpunk, I had spent probably about 6 months pissing about with the physics settings in that game to get it to behave, because I didn't follow the expected norm, which was to sort of fake the physics in sort of retro pixel games. I wanted it to be fully respect the physics in the engine, and I just tweaked it mercilessly to get it to behave to a point where it was quite stable. But in Kickback Slug, it was pretty evident a lot of work was going to be required to get it to be stable, because if you shoot yourself too fast and you're already against quite a thin collider, you just go through it. And so we tweaked the physics settings, we got it to behave, and we found that maybe rather than being a small single screen self-contained space, you actually had a bit of a bigger sandbox to play with. And that's when we started to think about what kind of character is this thing going to be. It's something that can't move or can't move very fast. So I said, with all due respect to slugs in the world, they serve our ecosystem very well. What is the most useless character you could think of, or useless animal you could think of, who's going to be responsible for saving the world? And that's when I thought of our good friend, the slug. Originally, it was a snail, but I did actually see on Twitter once a game where you played as a snail, and I can't remember exactly what the gameplay was, but it was a side-scrolling game where you play as a snail and you can make yourself go fast, you can shoot things. Otto, do you know what the game is?
No, but I have a question. So in Sweden, the word for slug and snail is the same word.
Oh!
So for us who are uneducated, what is the difference exactly?
Right, okay, so a snail carries with it a humongous shell on the back, which most of its kind of vulnerable organs, I think, I suppose. I'm not an expert in this, so I'm probably just making shit up. But all of the vital organs are in there. The slug is just the same thing, but without the shell. So that was literally the reason why we changed it from a snail to a slug, because that guy had made that game and it was getting quite a lot of traction. So out of respect for him, we thought, okay, let's just change it to a slug. But in our defense, again, we decided that this was a great idea to remove the platforming elements, because can you imagine like a slug just kind of shooting itself around, literally just through the kickback of its guns? We initially went for traditional guns, so a pistol which gives you a bit of semi-automatic, a bit of a push, then you had a shotgun, which as you can imagine is going to send you flying, and finally an SMG for sustained jetpack like movement. But then as the sort of the game started to materialize, we were looking at things like Earthworm Jim, if you remember that cartoon series, and I think there's a game, is there a game of that coming out soon as well, did I see, or am I mistaken, or a reboot of the series? I'm not really sure.
That sounds very familiar.
Something, maybe I'm making stuff up, but did I see something where it was like claymation style animation as well?
Oh, really?
You might have to cut this out, Otto, because I think I might actually be barking up the wrong tree here. But either way, classic Earthrun Gym was one of the main inspirations for the style, and that's when it was like, let's just target kids. So we got rid of the guns and changed it to be more kid-friendly things. Now, Rune earlier mentioned about making videos that was nothing more than about poop and fart jokes. One of the original ideas, and what we were convinced to not do it, was to make it all about farts. So if you're familiar with a larvae cartoon on Netflix, which I think is literally just called Larvae,
yes,
they are known for their fart and gas jokes and things like that. The original idea was, yeah, you would do a quick for a pistol shot, then it was like a proper for the cannon blast, and finally a hiss, like a pssss. But when we actually had that idea tested, the consensus was it became annoying, which was quite surprising, because the 12-year-old in me was absolutely in hysterics every time, just going around in a map was just funny, really, really funny. I'm almost 34, but that made the inner child in me absolutely happy. Nevertheless, we decided to compromise, and we changed it so that you had like a blaster type gun, like in Looney Tunes, you know, Martin the Martian, he had like this little blaster gun. And then we wanted to make it a bit of a pun, so it became the handgun, where it would shoot hands, like Mickey Mouse white gloves, yeah. And then we changed the cannon to be an actual cannon gun, kind of like a force push in Star Wars. It just blows out air. But the surviving element was the jet crack. So the jet crack is the only fart joke left, which is that hiss of gas.
I noticed there when I died, or when he's still, he had two guns.
Yeah, so of this is why I said the word arsenal. early on, because it literally is the weapons of his arsenal. But it's only the jetcrack, but he's got two guns, so it's the blaster, which is the pistol, and then the cannon, which is essentially your shotgun blast. So that's the purple tube you would have seen that looks suspiciously like something else, but I won't say that in case kids are listening.
Yeah, I've got to say, like, I gave such a shit review when we started, so you might have to cut that out, or I wasn't prepared for it. I just wrote down, like, the things I really liked. And yeah, I wondered why a slug. You sort of answered that question. We actually have a slug problem here at home right now, which was funny that I played a slug game now. But yeah, I did also notice that the punch, when you shoot, he shoots away a punch. I thought that was also a charming and cute detail. Like, the whole game is very charming and humoristic in a neat way. I like that. And I also wondered, one of the just random question is, the foreground is like all these black details. I'll call it the foreground. Is that auto-generated, or is that like hand-drawn?
Yeah, so Dan is pretty much responsible for the vast majority of the graphics that you see. He is someone who will animate anything and everything if it can be, mostly by hand. We do use a lot of plugins to achieve the visuals. The main one is something called Fur2D, which is an asset on the store that allows you to generate the Rayman-esque level style. And then the foreground elements, I think, are just sprites that he overlaid in the scene that follows the camera in a parallax style fashion. And then you might have seen the animated sequence at the end. When you get to the level complete screen, there's those like aliens waving and things like that. That's all hand animated. I think he uses, it's not Creature, it's the other one that everyone uses. Is it Spine?
Spriter?
No, I think it's called Spine, but then again, I could be wrong. I'll find that out. Either way, it's a 2D animation tool that he uses an editor for, and then there's native Unity support, which allows him to bring it in straight away, as is, like, bone. Either way, it's bone-based animation.
Nice. They're very smooth animations. I thought they were high quality.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I thought bone-based animation would be exclusive to adult games only.
Yeah, no boning in this game, I'm afraid. It's all kid friendly. There is, you might have noticed, the obvious political message in it, or maybe you didn't, I don't know. It's sort of on the nose. There are sort of big corporations in the world today that pretty much deliver anything and everything you ask for. So the collectibles, if you've collected any and you went to the gallery to open the boxes, that was a cool idea to actually give the collectibles a little bit of purpose rather than just the thing that you collect and you kind of move on. So you collect a box, like a lost parcel. If you haven't noticed this, by the way, the slug is a courier. He's a postman. And the idea is that he's got this massive delivery run. So this is where the Futurama inspiration came in, that you are on your way to a planet in some kind of system. And you've got all these parcels to deliver. You've got the whiny co-op buddy, which again is a spoof of the buddy system, like in Spyro and Zelda and things like that. He's meant to be this old fly, alien spider fly, who's just absolutely fed up with like his life. But here he is delivering parcels because he's too young to retire, ironically. And the corporation that you work for maybe looks suspiciously like a big corporation who launches rockets here and there and delivers pretty much anything you'd want to order. Started off just selling, but I'm not going to say who, just in case we get sued. But it is a bit of a commentary on... In fact, it's not even commentary. We're not criticizing anyone. It's just the fact that if you go over to a certain website and you wanted to order like a bathrobe or a bath mat or a toilet scrubber, you could just get anything and everything from that one website and then it gets delivered to you. That's kind of what this is.
Well, I hope the employees in this fictional universe at least gets toilet breaks.
So there actually is a piece of dialogue that we recorded that addresses that exact point. Let's just say for every toilet break he has, poor old Slippy has deducted some of his pay.
Oh, poor buggers.
Again, not a commentary at all. Not, no messages here, just fun.
You should add those things that you have at the end of movies, like any similarities to reality, so pure coincidence and blah blah blah.
Absolutely, it's just dawned on me that I've not added that to the credits, so I will, after this, straight onto Trello to create a ticket.
It's interesting, I like that you have that sort of message. I didn't notice it. When I start playing, I was just sort of pure fun and very charming. So I didn't really pay attention to that it was a message here. But I think that's also the beauty with art in general, that even though you said it was on the nose, like I didn't really pay attention to it, but for others they will. But I am curious to check out my collectibles now, see what I got. I picked up a couple of them, so that would be interesting.
Yep, go and check them out. You might be surprised on what you've just retrieved. Nothing sinister or anything like that. Again, it's just our attempt to be punny and funny at the same time.
Cool. And how long did it take from the idea phase to releasing it on Steam, would you say?
Ah, yes. So this is where it becomes interesting. So I mentioned earlier about the game being short. We never intended it to become as big as it is now. And it was a natural consequence of, as you start to become quite excited and enthusiastic about the ideas that you work on, naturally you start to think, wow, it would be cool if we could do this. And suddenly that month-long game jam that we started became 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 7 months. And it just became so big. And then we didn't really have a plan to release it at this point. It was a bit of a limbo state, but this is where my buddies over at Priory Digital come in. That's A Priory, I meant to say. Sorry, I forgot. I got a bit of a hard time pronouncing words quickly. So A Priory and I worked together on a previous project, and they're a porting studio, but also publish titles as well. They're very indie friendly, and they're good buddies of mine. And just on a random catch up I had with the sort of lead producer of the studio, I showed them Kickback Slug, and at this point it was starting to like materialize and become an actual polished product. And we were thinking about Steam at that point, but we didn't have a solid plan to put it on Steam yet. And I asked them to take a build, see what they thought, if there's any potential in it. Could it be released on Nintendo Switch? Is there something there? And after a positive response from them, they kindly offered to publish it to the consoles. So that's when we thought, okay, this is no longer a game anymore. This is now more or less a product. But we're going to inject as much of our passion and love for games into it as much as we can, and then think about a release date. So we were thinking, okay, so this was probably, I want to say, late 2021, and I just started my full-time course leader position at the university, which quickly swallowed all of my time, and all of a sudden we got to early 2022, and our original April release date was just not going to happen. And then it just pushed to the summer, and then the summer happened. When you work at university, the sort of everyday responsibilities is just so unpredictable and uncertain that, you know, all of a sudden when you think you've got nothing to do this week, you could do some game dev, all of a sudden your schedule's filled up again, and it just became more and more difficult. Thankfully, we managed to rope in some friends that I used to teach a long time ago who were studying at university, and because we didn't no longer have that work student, like employee student relationship anymore, they said that they wanted to come and help out. So I was like, go for it. They're very talented programmers, eager to get their teeth sunk into a live project. And whilst I couldn't pay them, I said, you can use this game for whatever you want to get you work, to further your career, exploit everything about it. It's a live console title that, you know, you're going to basically have on your belt before you even graduate. And I think they were quite okay with that arrangement. And if this game does end up making a bit of money, I promised to come back to them with something just to thank them for their efforts. But we'll wait and see, because obviously we have no idea if this game is going to make money at all. So that's the Priory situation. So we're like, great, all of a sudden we've now got a game that we can release on consoles with just no clear release date, because they're friends of mine. They're very flexible in how we're doing all of this. So it's not like a tight deadline of sorts. It's just, hey, just let us know when it's ready. But then obviously that's when we started to go on and on and on and on, and it's like, you know, we need to actually finish this. So we then started conversations with another company, and they're called Bonus Stage. So I met them online a while back, and they're an indie publishing company based in Finland. So not very far away from you, Otto, I assume. We had a bit of a catch up. We were talking about Catpunk and some other things. They really liked Catpunk. They wanted Catpunk, but we weren't really in a position. If we couldn't finish Kickback Slug, there's no way we were going to be able to finish Catpunk without some form of backing, because they weren't able to give us money for dev costs. But they basically offered everything else, like everything else to support the development and release of the game. So I took it to Dan, and Dan was like, yeah, let's do it, and because then it would give us a deadline to work towards. And then once that was all signed and sealed and delivered, all the contracts were in place. Bonus Stage handling the PC distribution, A Priori handling the console distribution. We're like, okay, now we've got the means to get this game done. Let's set a deadline. So July 31st, 2023 is the official handover date to get this game over to everyone else to do their bit, with hopefully finally a release in October. I don't have an exact date in mind yet, but it's looking like October 26th, around that sort of time, to a simultaneous release on everything. So long story short, this was a game jam project that we never meant to release. It grew into something else, and here we are almost 2.5 years later, and finally it's got a release date.
Wow. Mm.
Cool. Very cool. And would you say that 2 years, is that 2 years full time, or is it like once a week, or how much?
Absolutely not. No, not full time. I would say in that 2.5 year period, it's mainly evenings, weekday evenings. So Dan and I, we're quite committed to game development. We want this that much that we make time. So I used to have quite a lot of time in the evenings. It would just be a case of having my dinner and then straight onto dev. And my wife's been so understanding and supportive of that course, because you know how much it means to me to make this work. But then after my son was born, and I think I mentioned this last time when I was here, that time has dwindled. That's why the game was delayed so much, because all of a sudden my ability to commit to solid hours of programming was reduced from about, on a good day, 6 hours, down to maybe an hour, if at all, because I'm absolutely fried by the time I get to the end of the day. My son's gone to bed. He's not the best sleeper either. He's now protesting going to bed, so that makes it even more difficult for us to get him down. And by the time I sit down, I look at my Trello board, and I see all of these really big programming tasks, and I just can't be bothered because I'm just so tired, you know. And then the two programmers, so Gabe and Nick, shout out to them. You know, they're still sort of getting their careers off the ground. Gabe is still at university, and Nick has just managed to bag himself his first game dev job. I mean, which I believe the experience with us is what helped him get that job as well. So very, very, it's very nice to know that the contributions they've made has helped further their own careers. So it's just me now coding on the project pretty much with whatever time I can squeeze, and it's not that much. But thankfully, much of the donkey work is done. The only major thing left to go at the time of recording this is the localization system, which you picked up on. There's a lot going on there. It doesn't work very well. And for the Xbox One, I can't go into too much details because of NDAs, but let's just say it runs like a bit like dog poop on the on the base Xbox One. So I'm already aware that a lot of optimization is needed, and Dan will be pushing really hard on the artwork to get that running crisp. And then I'm refactoring the localization system as we speak, so it's not so, because there's a lot of overhead going on there. It's like a massive CSV file that the game pulls in, and it kind of loads it every time, and because it's quite taxing on the reading from the hard drive, because the Xbox One hard drive is, I think it's like an old 5400 RPM hard drive, so naturally it's really, really slow. The game just hangs when the menu comes up because it's loading the localization. So what I'm doing now is refactoring it and using threading to be able to try and smooth that out. The reason why it goes out of sync, by the way, are you familiar with coroutines in Unity? It's that way we can simulate like threaded behavior through it, like taking tasks and breaking them into time-boxed sort of chunks. So it's like you have a task, you want it to recur like 100 times, but you want to do that over time. So what I initially did is I put it all in a coroutine where it would grab the data and one by one just change it over time. So that's why it goes, it's like flashing. But then I quickly realized it was a horrible solution because, yeah, coroutines are just not the greatest tool. They're useful, granted, but not the optimal way of doing it, which is why it goes out of sync, because they're just hard to control. Sorry, that was a long string of unnecessary tech information. So long story short, it needs to be redone. and I'm seeing the consequence of this now.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, so something like localization, I'm thinking that, just thinking out loud here without having done it myself, of course, but localization is usually something you would only change once. So wouldn't it make sense to have it as if you change which language it is, then you would have to restart the game, and then it loads only the language that you want it to display, because it's not, it wouldn't be a viable use case that in the middle of the game you want to change it to Russian for some reason.
I have a thing or two to say about localization, because I went to localization hell and back. Like, I noticed one thing when you send a game, for example, to Nintendo, this is one of the things they will check. They will go into the option menu, change the language to whatever, and then play the game, save the game, turn it off, and then turn it back on, and then load the game, and then it has to be the language that you chose last time. So that has to be saved somewhere. Like, I said it before, I think it's so... I still don't understand this loading and saving stuff. But with my Red Colony 3, like, I just couldn't make this shit work. So I just made the... After the splash screen, like, runic codes, and then, bam, pick your language. So you have to pick your language every time you start up the game. And if you go back in time, like Rayman 1, for example, on PlayStation 1, they also had that. You always had to pick the language from the... before you even reach the start scene, the start screen. So that's how I solved it. And then it's like, well, this is how it is now, because I couldn't make it work that you could change the language. And what you said there, Odo, like, isn't this something you only do once? Like, when I made my games, I was so like living in Japan, I mean, like, everyone wants to learn English, and I thought, like, when I make games, I'm gonna make it possible to change anytime you want in the game. Because if you are, for example, Japanese and you want to learn English, and then, for example, Red Colony 2, it was localized to, or the dubbed to Japanese. And then I was thinking, like, what if there's someone who want to play it in English so he could hear the Japanese voices and read the English stuff? So I want to give that option. But when I did that, it just, like, caused the biggest headaches ever, because then, yeah, this whole, it has to save it too somewhere. And I'll have a similar system as you, Jamie. I think, like, it fetches all the language stuff from an Excel file or something like that, and sort of replace it in the menus and stuff like that. But I never experienced that it was sort of lagging or anything like that. But yeah, just this thing. This is the annoying thing when you make games, and also when you don't make games and don't understand how they're made. Like, this thing can be so damn complicated and difficult to solve, even though it seems like the easiest thing ever. I don't know, I was just ranting there.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, I need to build a localization system, and if you assign that task to 100 different programmers, I imagine they'll come up with 100 different solutions. But the consensus seems to be, when I actually researched this after I had done it, where the best thing to do is kind of a mix of what Otto was saying. The fact that you can instantly change the language at any point and it just switches is actually a nice selling point, because it allows people to maybe go to their native language and then decide, actually, no, wait, I'm going to go back to English, and it's a quick menu switch. But yeah, I also like the idea of giving them the option early. It reminds me of games, mainly, I guess, on PS1 days, actually. I don't recall seeing this recent, where they gave you the flags before the game would even boot up to choose which one you wanted. It was mainly, in our case, just the European languages. And that was it. You were locked in and you had to physically reboot the game to change it. But yeah, in this case, it does save it to your profile. Like, what language is just an enum, where that it decides, you know, what your language is. So when you reboot the game, it should automatically go into that language. But I think Otto raised a really good point, and the drop-down box is a crucial element, because at the moment, I opted to have the menu sort of simple in that you just click it and it just cycles. But, you know, then I added, like, keys. So if you highlight it with the mouse, you can use the left and right keys. You can use the arrow keys. You can use the shoulder buttons as well if you're using controller, just to quickly cycle along. But then, yeah, if I want to navigate to Russian, I've got to go through, like, several languages before I even get there. It's a tricky thing. So what I'm actually doing at the moment is taking that CSV file, which I made just for convenience. So when I handed it out to my friends who are kindly taking the time out to translate it all, everything's just in there in one big monster sheet. But what I'm now doing is I built a little tool that takes that CS file and breaks it up into a series of text files. And because Unity can natively read text files, you can drag that into the inspector, or rather just load it from resources, and then it's there in memory. And what I found in my research is it's better just to leave it in memory, because, you know, hardware these days, are we do have quite a lot of memory, so a string file that doesn't have that many strings in it is not a big deal. So that's my plan, is to sort of say, oh, you're in French mode, so it takes the French text file, loads it in, it's just there. So when the menus need to consult it, it's already quite an instant process. Whereas at the moment, originally what it was doing was loading that sheet, and then it would cycle through all the different columns, all the different rows to find the matching string. That's where the, because every menu does that at least once when it appeared, just to sort of offset it a bit. In the Xbox One, when I was looking at the gameplay footage, they would press the pause button and they would like hang for a second, and then it would just show up because it's like loading that file. So that's what I'm now doing as part of the refactoring process, is just breaking it up so you don't have all the languages instantly available, just the one that you actually need, which would hopefully make things better. We'll see. But I plan to redo it again for Catpunk, because I haven't got localization in there yet, and this time I'm going to research this properly. And Oswald, obviously, who will be helping me, might end up actually doing it himself. And I know that he's a very talented programmer who knows a lot about best practice, so I'm sure he'll be able to propose a really good solution for that.
Yeah. And I thought maybe something to the effect of what you said, so that you could, I guess, I mean, even if you would have 20 languages in there, and I mean, I don't know how much text is in the whole game, but if you would load all of it into memory, and then like every game object that has texts on it, that you would, every time you would change the localization option, then it would just display French instead of display English, and then so you would have everything. But maybe that also makes it lag, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's just the matter of, because it's loading that massive CSV file, so it's got 336 rows of text in it, minus one because the headings are just the language for readability. So 335 strings, and they range from things like play, press any button, all the way to the long dialogue lines that you see in the cutscene. And if you think about it, on a 4K monitor, it's really hard to see all the text. So it's a Google Sheet, so everyone can easily access it, and then I download that CSV file. But even on a 4K screen, it's really hard to navigate, because there's just so much like long lines, and you can't use text wrapping because it's just a CSV file or anything like that. So you have to navigate. It's quite, and if you imagine that whole sheet being loaded at once, you can see why a 2012/2013 era of hardware would struggle to read it. And as I say, because it's a really old hard drive, I imagine there's a nice lag just to retrieve that file and read it. Anyway, like I say, it's a horrible solution, and anyone who's listening who's worth their salt will probably be cringing too, like, what a horrid solution. So rest assured, I'm redoing it from the ground up, so it only loads what it actually needs to load. I should have done it. You know what? It's the reason why I took this approach, it was probably because of my flippant attitude towards today's contemporary hardware. The problem is, we've got these high-end PCs. I don't have the most powerful machine in the world, but it's future-proof for at least another few years before I would need to upgrade the CPU and things like that. I also went for 32 gigs of RAM as well, because I think that's now becoming the norm. So when I built Kickback Slug, I'm running on a very powerful machine, so I don't notice these glitches. Like, I don't have a widescreen monitor, so I didn't even think about a 21:9 ratio in this case. You know, so that, and then everything's just now broken because I spent so much time anchoring all the UI elements to a 16:9/10 ratio, because the vast majority of people that play this game, I think, will be playing either in 1080 or 4K, whether it's on console or otherwise. So, you know, these things just never really entered my mind, and I think this is something we may have discussed last time, but because today's hardware is just so powerful, you start to think less about optimization. Even like a PS5 and the Xbox Series X, very powerful machines, they are technically constrained hardware that's not going to improve anytime soon, unless they release, I guess, a follow-up model. But for now, it's like frozen in time. So you target that hardware, and because that hardware is still quite powerful, you've got this huge buffer where it's like, you know, I get solid 60 frames per second, I'm not going to bother. It's only until I saw that Xbox One footage, that's when it really hit me, like, shit, I should have done this properly. Because that's when the stuttering was there, and that's because we've got quite a lot of visual effects which we need to tweak. I'm not allowed to talk about the PS version, unfortunately, because of Sony's NDAs, but there are some different visual artifacts going on there that we need to change because of the different hardware configurations. And that's when it really, really hit me. Like, I've actually got a ton of work to do. So that July 31st deadline is starting to make me sweat. And it's not just the heat outdoors. It's that. So again, it creates this conversation about how much optimization do we need to do? Like, we're not in the Sega Genesis era anymore where you'd optimize the hell out of everything. And there's a great YouTube channel, which if I can remember what it was called, I'd recommend it. It's a guy who used to work on the Toy Story Sonic games on the Sega Genesis, and he gave like a good technical breakdown of how those technological advancements were achieved, which was quite innovative at the time. And now fast forward to 2023, and you can like put together these really horrifyingly optimized games, and because they run at 60 frames per second, it the user won't care. Does that make sense? Like, it's an interesting discussion. Like, is optimization as important today than, say, sort of 10, 15 years ago?
I don't know if I told you, Odo, this, I think I did, with Red Colony 3, I only play with the, let's see, not the joystick, the joypad, the pads.
Oh, the joypad. I love that, joypad.
Well, the cross or whatever.
Like a controller, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I sent that game in, right, to Nintendo and all that. Nintendo of Japan, they realized that one scene, like one of the levels in the game, is the frame rate just crashes when you play with the joysticks.
Oh, wow.
I thought, yeah, and because it's like in update, in Void Update, it's like updates every frame, and there's a lot of things happening in that scene, and so you have to fix this. But I think it was the European Nintendo didn't notice this. I assume that the game tester there played with the buttons, the joy pads, whatever, and they didn't notice it. But yeah, that was just, wow. Like, and it's what you're talking about. Like, some things, even though you made a game, you just don't notice it yourself. So I never played my own game with the joysticks. For all I knew, maybe I could have chipped a game where it doesn't even work, because I never play 2D games with the joysticks. So I was very surprised when I got that feedback. Like, the game is just lagging like hell on the, in this particular place. And I was like, no, it's not. What are you talking about? And then I realized, ah, shit. When I use the joystick, it's just like throwing a billion commands every frame. And that's what made it lag.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This is, if I had the resources, I would have this game tested every single week. You know, AAA companies have the luxury of a QA department or outsourcing to a QA department. Sorry, a QA company. And, you know, they can get, like, on-the-spot feedback and reactions to features and stuff and so on throughout dev, right? But I guess in our case, because we are such a small team with no sort of budget, we're making these games because we love games and we want to make games and so on, we don't think about those practices, if you like, that you would employ on a live software development project. Whereas if you're working in a studio, you know, supposedly under the support of a very experienced senior technical lead who would be saying everything has to be rigorously unit tested. We'll have a white box testing session like once a month, then we'll have a black box tested, and then we'll send it out to QA. You only push commits like when it's been tested, and then it's merged to the main dev branch. And it's such a rigorous testing process, whereas ours were just like, hey, it works, commit it, push, off, we're done. And then it just takes one person to sort of play with a D-pad or what did you say, sorry, the joy controller. That sounded really different.
Yeah, I don't know, the arrow, the cross on the PlayStation, the arrows versus the stick.
The D-pad, yeah.
Ah, D-pad, there we go, yeah.
Yeah, the D-pad, and then all of a sudden everything breaks. So again, like Otto pointed out about changing the language, because my approach to dev was, well, I'm a mouse and keyboard snob, I'm happy just to click the option and have it cycle through. I don't really care. But that's just my philosophy in design, I suppose. It's what I care about versus, again, and you've got to think like that, isn't it? The wider consensus, like everyone's going to play these games with different hardware configurations and then different sort of preferences when it comes to navigating UI. I'm, like I say, I could just click with a mouse because that's just what I'm used to. But a lot of the people, surprising amount of people use controllers for PC games, you know, and you just forget about these things. Like even be able to navigate the menu using the actual stick itself just by flicking it downwards once is something I forgot to do for ages. And someone was like, oh, I can't navigate the menus unless I use the D-pad. So my first reaction was like, well, use the D-pad. And then it's like, oh, no, hang on. Sorry, take that hat off. I'm an everybody person. I then implemented that feature. But my point is, joking aside, is having this tested with as many different people and friends and family and so on as possible is kind of key to, I guess, to finding these issues that are not entrenched or in any way connected to your dev cycle. Does that make sense? Which is why black box testing, I suppose, is a valuable tool in that regard.
Yeah, and I think hopefully soon I'm going to be on my way to releasing something, so I can't really speak with experience. But in my job, when I do testing, I think a good attitude to have towards testing is always not just to make it work, but to explicitly try to break your own stuff as much as you can. If you can think of like, oh, maybe I can do this weird thing and then it will break, then try to do as many of those as you can. So for example, like with web development that I've done, is that I try to do like the screen as small as possible. Like no phone even has this small screen, but I want to break it to see where does it break and how can I break it? Because you will have probably somebody out there who has some weird configuration or like explicitly tries to find a bug and then complain about it or something.
Or has an ultra wide monitor, right?
Yeah, exactly. That douchebag.
Interesting what you said, Oda. I always had attitude, as long as it works for me, I use push GitHub bomb. There we go. But I think I wrote to you in Discord recently, Oda, that with the dialogue system I'm making for my new game, this is the third time I'm redoing it because I want it to be as perfect as possible. And like I'm sort of trying to break it as well, because I think that not only is it good for the player in the end, but it's also, I also think that when you make it more solid, it's all obviously better for you as well when you bug test the game later on. And also that you learn stuff on the way, how to think and how to sort of approach everything in your game from different angles and all that. That's very useful stuff. But I've been very arrogant in the past. It works for me, I'm fine. It's good. But now I learned the hard way, though.
It's a natural bias.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's a natural bias, and you can't help feel that way. But if you try to stick to a strict regimen, or if you try to discipline yourself to think a little bit more about just you and your own preferences, it's kind of key to these projects. But that's why, I suppose, if we're lucky enough to be working in a bigger team, it's quite easy to, I guess, employ that philosophy.
Yeah, but I really like the philosophy that John Romero, one of the co-creators of Doom, has when it comes to testing and bugs. So he has a couple of rules for game development that he follows. So one of them is, and this is just nothing towards anyone, just what I try to follow myself. That is, first of all, that he says that, at least in his day, they didn't have a real QA department, so every programmer was responsible for their own bugs, so that there is nobody to test it. You are responsible for making sure that there are no bugs in your game. And if you think that, oh well, I have a QA department, then you're just gonna build something buggy and then not care about it, and then that's just gonna waste people's time.
It's kind of like how games are being released nowadays, except that the end consumer is the tester.
Yeah, and he said something like, even if you have a QA department, you shouldn't let anyone see your bugs. And that's sort of, I think that's something that I felt was a really good attitude, that it doesn't matter if there is a QA department, just try to not let anyone know that there are bugs in there. And that way, when the QA department does receive it, then they will have less work to do, and they will start from a better position, so they will have more like important things to add to feedback than just, hey, this stuff this doesn't work and you could have like solved it in a minute. Something he added to that was that if you, because he thought that the priority you should have for doing stuff is fix all of the bugs first and then new features. Because if you don't fix all of the bugs as the first priority, then you will build the rest of it on a faulty foundation. So you will build something on something that is buggy. So then when you fix that bug, then you will have to change the feature maybe as well, because it was assuming that it worked like with the bug, sort of.
Yeah, I think that's really wise words in a way. And I think that was, I think they were a victim of circumstance. It reminds me of a talk I watched of his recently, which is on YouTube. And this was during a time when I guess this type of development cycle was still pretty much new, right? And when they were making Doom, you know, they didn't even have like source control. I don't even know if it was a thing, a proper practice back then, but they just handed floppy disks to each other with all of their updated pieces of code. And I guess those kinds of philosophies that you speak of were just a consequence of that, I guess, not rigid structure that they had. It was more like, you know, because everything's quite, I guess, more delicate, if it goes wrong, it'll be catastrophic. So you're in this mindset, like, just rigorously test because you're not going to get it tested anywhere else. I think that's what led to another discussion about how the nightmare difficulty was added, because I don't think that was tested either. It was pretty much broken, I think. And in fact, didn't even come out and say that it was meant to be a joke. Again, I could be wrong, so if Romero happens to be listening right now, I do apologize, my friend. You're a legend, though, and I love you very much, and you're an inspiration. But I think it was meant to be a joke, and there's a video about there, because obviously the source code is available now, isn't it, for Doom, and they were talking about how the nightmare mode was constructed. It's literally just if nightmare just overrides a load of settings, and I don't think it was meant to be tested, which is why it was broken, because I think the pinkies, they instantly teleport to your location and things like that, don't they? But either way, cool stuff. I didn't actually have a point to that. It's just an interesting observation.
We're starting to, I think we're actually over a bit of an hour, but there's another thing I would like to talk about before we end the episode. So I was curious, so you release on sometime in October, maybe something like that. And what is the future for the game? So is it just releasing and then done, or are you planning on doing like DLCs or updates, or will there be sort of a Santa DLC or something for Christmas? I don't know.
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure, and that's only because I'm still trying to sort out Catpunk's future. Without giving too much away, I'm now talking to some people again about it. Nothing to announce or report on, but the conversations are happening. In a way, putting my creative hat on, I treat projects in a way like snakeskin. So when I finish a project, if I'm lucky to actually get to a finishing stage, I shed that skin and I kind of put it to one side because I like to focus on the next challenge. Kickback Slug was, again, like, I love the project. It's very important to me. It wasn't meant to be, like, in a way what it is now, but it just happened through natural consequence, and I'm just determined to kind of see that through. My view on this game is it's kind of like a stepping stone in a way to bigger and better things. That's my hope. I cross my fingers, and I don't mean to speak so ill of the project. I do see it as an important step in my career. Like, one of the things that I think all indie games, or sorry, I mean indie developers face, or one of the significant challenges is who you are and who you know. This game is only being ported to console because I knew the A Priori guys, and they were good friends of mine, and they were happy to take it on. We did pitch it to a couple of publishers, and they were just like, ah, no, because they keep seeing it as a platformer. And even though I tried to say it's not a platformer, it's a hard thing to communicate. Anyway, my point is, like, the challenge that you face is because we don't have many games under our belts, we don't have, forgive the expression, but big balls to swing. We, you know, if I came to a publisher and like, hey, I just published, you know, three titles, all reviewed very well, made quite a bit of money, and it's on every single console, you're more likely to get a deal. Whereas I come to them as a nobody, pretty much, and it's like, here's this project, we want to work with you, can you? And they look at it and think, oh, you know, it's kind of like starting from scratch for them as well, isn't it? Whereas if it was an already established studio, you're more likely to get that deal. Does that make sense? Like, am I making sense here? So Kickback Slug, in a way, is a calling card, like to say to publishers when we go back to them with Catbunk, hey, we've already got a ship title under our belt, we made it entirely by ourselves with our own resources, we've got a development network of people that have been helping out over the years, and we just now need something to push this project forward. So as a way just to sort of put weight on our application, if you like. It's kind of like when you hire someone as well, I suppose. You get given a resume or a CV, and it's like you look at the projects that they've previously done or the companies that they've worked at, and if they've got quite a few companies under their belt already versus someone else who maybe has the same skill level but doesn't have as many or doesn't have the track record, you're more likely to go with the former. So that's kind of my attitude towards this, as Kickback Slug is hopefully a stepping stone to bigger things, and obviously therefore makes it just as important as Catpunk, arguably.
Yeah, and coincidentally, slugs are something you step on, so...
Yes, in a way. Then this is a nice little tale to show that when the fate of everyone's parcels being delivered on time is in the tentacles of a little alien slug, I think there's a lot to be said there.
Mm.
Very good. And I think with those words, we should start wrapping up the episode. But before we do that, Rune, do you have any additional questions or anything I've missed?
No, very satisfied. Interesting to hear you, like everything about it is really interesting to hear.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
I like having you on. It's really, last time too, you guys gave a lot of insight, and even though I'm a developer, like, you guys are on a different level. I feel like I'm learning so much. So thank you for coming on again, and really enjoy listening to your story and the adventure with the slug and Catpunk's the slug.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. Unlike Catpunk, there is a Steam page for Kickback Slug, so you can now wishlist it, and I'd very much appreciate it if you would. And rest assured, you guys will, well, no offense to the listeners, but you guys will get obviously free keys. For everyone else, please do consider wishlisting and purchasing when it comes out.
Perfect. Yeah, anything else you want to promote or anything where you want to send our listeners?
No, I will just I will end on a quick shout out. You know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the effort of everyone who's contributed to the project so far. Even though it's a small game, the credits list is already quite big. If it wasn't for those people who kindly gave up their time because they wanted to contribute to a really cool project, you know, I thank them. So that's Gabe and Nick for the programming efforts, Varia for the voice work, Giovanni for the narrative, Oswald for the testing. Oh God, I'm going blank. We've got other people, Anne as well. Anne, who joined us as an intern, did an amazing job just helping out on design, production, bit of art, bit of everything else, level design. Fantastic. It's a collaborative effort. And one of the things about indie development, which is probably the best thing, is the collaborative nature of indie projects in general. So I'm very, very grateful for everyone's help, including you guys for kindly having me on here and giving me the opportunity to speak and ramble about probably nonsense. A lot of nonsense, but yeah, this is why I love doing what I do, because of the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just say the same as Rune, that I'm really glad to have you on. It's sort of a conversation where I had like 15 other questions, but we'll have to do another follow-up episode, and you're welcome back anytime.
Oh, thank you. I would love to take you up on that. It would be nice to shoot the breeze on, I guess, game development philosophies and things like that. Whenever you want, I'm here.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, it's been really, really nice, and we hope to see you back soon. And to our listeners, I hope you buy Kickback Slug. I will send you the link in the description, so nobody please miss it. Just buy it. We don't have a huge audience yet, but hopefully we'll get you a couple of sales at least, so knock on wood.
That's great. And if you're just in case you forgot, it's going to be on Steam, GOG, Xbox One, Series S, Series X, PS4, PS5, Switch. It's going to be everywhere. And it's also very, very kid friendly. There's no violence or anything like that. It's suitable for all ages, and the game as well should be accessible to everyone as well. But if you're struggling, I guess, to beat levels in the first zone, then that's a game design problem I need to fix. But yeah.
Perfect, yeah, then you have no reason not to buy it when it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Slugs are going to be taking over. I'm hoping to take it to some game dev conferences soon. So there's EGX, I believe, in October here in the UK, and we'll take it to other conferences next year as well.
Very, very cool. All right, well, with those words, I think we'll wrap up the episode. And thank you, Rune, for the great intro and being my co-host as always.
Hi.
Thank you, Jamie, for a fantastic game. So I wish you the best of luck when you do release it. To everyone listening, thank you so much for staying with us all this way to the end. And we will see you next week. So have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers.